Moral of the story is marry up.
There you, exactly. Well, I told you when I came in, she's got good taste in everything except men, obviously. And I always get that. You know, yeah. They'll meet somebody, meet her, and go, "How did he get you?"
I get the same thing. Yeah, we were talking about Steve earlier, and we went to a party at his house, and it was the first time that anyone had met my wife, and she walks up first, and hello, and she walks by, and he looked at me and goes, like, "How'd you do this, dude?"
Welcome to the Most High Show, a show about recovery, spirituality, and all that. Produced, posted, and hosted by people in recovery who have strength and hope and want to share it with you. If you or someone you love is suffering, we want you to know you are not alone. This is the Most High Show.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Most High Show. We are kicking it off in the new studio, and with us today is Bill. Yep. Eubanks.
That's correct.
And Adam Miller. We got Leslie on the ones. Leslie is doing quality control, and Zach is on the ones and twos. And we got Dean and Kelly in the building hanging out with us. So this is going to be a good episode. It's our first episode of the new studio. Super excited. So Bill is a long-standing recovery specialist at No Longer Bound for over a decade. I think it's even more than...
Somewhere around 15 years, part of that time was in the program. Part of that time was being a servant leader. We called it SLT.
Oh, yeah.
Part of that was an unpaid employee.
Yeah.
So right at 15 years.
Wow.
I've been doing it. Been sober 17, been doing this for about 15.
All right. He's in recovery himself.
Absolutely.
Which gives you insight into it. And so welcome to the Most High Show.
Thank you. Thank you for asking me. This is great.
Yeah.
I'm honored to be here on your inaugural show in this studio.
Yeah, it's a big deal. And then, I don't know if anyone knows Adam, but Adam, you're a friend of the show. You're on a lot. And you've recently, you were at Bound for a while, and now you're...
Yeah.
But you work in the field.
I do, yep. Still in the field. I've worked in the field for 6 years now. Between Christian Sober Living, Christian Residential, Substance Use Disorder Treatment, and now I work for a few facilities, Substance Use Disorder and Mental Health.
Yeah. We can tell by your language you've moved up in the... You went corporate, baby. You went corporate.
That's what they... I mean, that's what they say.
But you're also CAC, right? Certified Addiction Counselor?
So CIT, CARES, CPS, AD.
CPS, that's who they call when your kids are acting up?
No. Oh. That's, what is that?
That's Child Protective Services.
Okay, no, it's not that.
That it's
Certified
that.
Peer Specialist for Addictive Disease.
Oh, yeah. All right.
I'm a CAC.
You're a CAC. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Certified Addictions Counselor.
Correct.
Yeah. So we're going to kick it off with a question. I'd love to know your answer.
Okay.
17 years in recovery, 15 years in a... in the business of it, and you've seen that place has evolved. And so in your own words, what is addiction?
Great question. I mean, I could give you the clinical answer for sure, but in my words, addiction is filling a hole, satisfying a need for love and acceptance, worth, or numbing the feelings that come when you don't have love, acceptance, and worth. And the insidious thing about it, and I think why it becomes an addiction, is it works to start out with.
Yeah.
You know, I tell everybody drugs weren't my problem. Drugs were my solution to my problems.
Yeah.
And it works and it keeps working and it keeps working and then it doesn't, you know?
And then you're screwed.
And then you're screwed. By then you're literally screwed.
Yeah.
Keep chasing that high. Keep chasing when it did work. Keep trying to relive the way it used to be. I mean, that's my story. So to me, it's just trying to satisfy those needs. And those are human needs. You know, we all need love, acceptance, and worth and want to feel accepted. And when you don't have that, you know, we always hear the opposite of addiction is connection. But addiction is a form of connection, just connection with a counterfeit source of love, acceptance, and worth.
Yeah, a synthetic solution. Yeah. Interesting.
What was that clinical definition?
I knew you'd call me on that, wouldn't you? Wait a minute, I'll pull it up for
you. I thought you had it on the top of the dome. I can't remember.
I don't know what it is.
It's got to do with all the behaviors you list, all, you know, continued use, even
despite increasing negative consequences.
Right, yeah, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Continued behavior.
Continued behavior.
Right, is what I think the verbiage, despite continuing or increased negative consequences.
Yep.
Which is pretty easy to, like, look at my, like, filter how I was living. It's like, oh, yeah, that fits that to a T.
Right.
Like you were talking about before we kind of kicked it off, these things kept increasing and your use did not decrease.
Right. And the thing is rationalizing and justifying that, you know, it's worked for so long, it's given me, I can't live without it, basically, because it is my only source. Yeah. You know, take it away from me, okay, then what? You know,
then you got to feel all the stuff.
Yeah. I'm not doing that.
I used to put my drugs in my, you know, your jeans have that little coin pocket.
Watch pocket, yeah.
Or watch pocket, if you're OG. But I'd put my pills or my dope in there. And as the day would go on, I'd just put my hand there to feel it, like it was there. And it was just gave me such a sense of security. Like, okay, cool, I got that. As long as that was there, I was okay. The problem was it just inevitably you run out. And then it's not there anymore.
You feel down there and it's not there. And it's like, not boom, there. Extreme panic.
Yes,
instant panic.
Yeah.
What am I going to do?
What am I going to do? I guess I could drink. You know, that was the second. Dean and I were talking earlier today, and there's a book called Breathing Underwater by Richard Rohr. Have you read that book?
I have not.
Oh, I highly recommend that. Yes. And in that book, he kind of asserts that all humanity is addicted to something, right? And this is kind of what Christians would call sin nature, and that those of us who are chemically addicted, right? But then there are other people who are addicted to greed, to power, to anger, and that these 12 steps can be a path out of that, right? The problem is, well, the blessing is because we're addicted to chemicals, it's obvious that our life is in shambles and obvious we need to make a change. But you can't really see things like greed in the mirror because the world system it rewards greed.
Sure.
Right? It rewards pride. It rewards envy. It rewards lust. And so those things don't get addressed. So thankfully, we picked gluttony, right? Or, you know, addiction, or we're chose to that or whatever, because it's so obvious to us that we need a solution. And it's obvious what happens if we go back. And I love the way he approaches that because if, you know, when was the last time you were at a church and the preacher talked about, you know, greed on Sunday morning, right? That's not a topic that's like very...
It's usually right before they're asking for donations, you know? They shame you a little bit, you know?
We love the church.
And then pass the plate around.
We love the church.
You know, it's like the hardest guys, I think, to work with in treatment are the guys that are hyper-intelligent. One, again, like you were saying, like we talk about it as like positive flesh.
Yeah, right.
These things that are killing us, but the world rewards it. And so it's hard to view it as a problem. Yeah. Because you're getting an affirmation for it every other place, even though it's killing you. So there's the hyper-intelligent guys, and they're like trained to trust their own thinking so strongly, even though the world's like burning around them. It's like, nah, I'm gonna think my way out of this.
I got this.
That, and then hyper like religious guys.
Yeah,
because that's a really good shield to use. You throw some scripture at somebody to kind of get them off of your back,
right?
You know, all the while like you're feeling empty inside, and it's just this. It's not like a spiritually feeling; it's a defense mechanism.
Yeah, yeah. It's just more ego and control. And not surrendering. And I was on a call with a guy today, and that's exactly what I told him. It's like, he's highly successful. And I said, the problem which is you won't surrender. You won't give up. And it's safe. You can surrender to God. It's safe. It's scary. And, you know, it might be hard, but it's safe. But he's so successful that he just keeps trying. Well, then if I just don't drink, and I'll just take these prescribed pills, when and I'll smoke some weed in the night and I'll do this. It's like, well, you're not sober. You're just not drinking. Right. And it, just because it's not your drug of choice, you think that it's just you're justified in using it. But it's still the same thing. You're escaping yourself or trying to, what you said, fill that void. Because ultimately, he's not comfortable with himself and probably hates himself at some level. Right?
You were talking about, I'm going to read that book for sure. You were talking about the world rewards.
Yeah.
That kind of behavior, the money, the greed, the all those things. You know, working a step one, you know, you say, is my life really unmanageable? Because the world says I'm managing it pretty doggone good.
Right.
You know, am I really powerless? Because I seem to have a lot of power. I started the 12 steps 100 times and did what I call 1, 2, 3 and out. I'd be on the board in an AA room and I'd say, yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, there's when I'm actually doing something. And never really worked a step one. Never really bought into the fact because I thought I could control some aspect of it.
Yeah.
I'll just only drink on the weekends. Won't do hard drugs, just drink. Only take prescriptions. Only, you know, the even have my script in the original container. Like, that's my get out of jail free card.
Right.
You know,
but,
yeah. You remind me of that video. I will not rebase cocaine. Yeah. I mean, I won't do the church unless I heard the sermon before and I might do a little toot in the back of church, but.
Unless I'm at a stop sign.
Yeah.
Unless someone offers it to me, then, you know, it'd be rude not to.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to be rude.
Go upside Sally's head and I'll get that kid.
Love that.
That's a great one. That's an interesting, that powerlessness, and that's step one.
Yeah.
You know, that's the only caveat to the steps, you know, is like really getting to that point. I think however we get to it, and I think I get to it on levels through my life in recovery, and at drugs was the first level, you know, and then it was like my thinking or my emotions, my relationships, you know, and so I have to keep taking these things back to this step filter, and my experience is every time no matter what I take through the steps, I get relief from the control that it had, you know, but the caveat is that step one's got to be. Yep.
My uncle asked me one time, I think it was like, I don't know, I was maybe in the program for 6 months and I had a phone call on the weekend and he was a big advocate for me getting in there and helped a lot with me getting to No Longer Bound. And he asked me, he's like, how do I know if I'm addicted to something? And like, what constitutes that? And the question I had that just popped off the top of my head is like, how do you feel when you don't have it? I don't know what he was referring to, maybe golf or something. He's like, oh. I think that's a good filter.
Yeah, the litmus test I always use is, okay, don't do it for a month. You know, and if all of a sudden you get a, whoa, that's this working out. You know, there's guys that are totally addicted to exercise and working out to a point that they're not managing it anymore. They can't manage live and they're powerless. And
right.
I say, hey, don't work out for a month. Whoa, I'll lose all my gains. What are you talking about?
Yeah. My friend Mark Danzy said, I don't care what you call it. If whatever you're doing is hurting you and the people you love,
mm-hmm.
stop doing it.
Yep.
And I've always thought that's such a good explanation of it. Like, it doesn't matter what it is. Like, I don't care what you call it. If it's hurting you and other people, maybe stop, you know? All right. Next question. In your experience, can an individual be cured from addiction or substance use disorder?
That's an interesting question.
In your experience?
Yeah, I got you.
Yeah.
I'll tell you something my experience has taught me is there is no definitive answers when it comes to recovery, addiction or recovery, that I can't tell somebody what's going to work for them and what's not going to work for them. The God I worship is all powerful, and I fully believe he can heal people from anything. In my experience, rarely have I seen anybody who doesn't actively maintain some sort of recovery, whatever that looks like for them, stay sober. Personally, you know, I was asked one time, if there was a pill you could take that would cure your addiction and you could go drink and use like a normal person, would you take it? And initially in early recovery, I was like, heck yeah, get me back out there. Now, no way. Absolutely not.
Why not?
Because my addiction, the disease of my addiction, is what makes me hit my knees every day.
Mm.
It's what keeps me. You know, we were in Lent recently, and Lent is giving up something to keep you mindful of God.
Yeah,
I'm in Lent 24/7. You know, I'm giving up something that was dear to me every day of my life. And it keeps me mindful and focused. It keeps me working those 12 steps with not just drugs and alcohol, with everything that comes into my into my life. I say the Serenity Prayer tons of times every day, rarely about drugs and alcohol. You know, it's always about something that I'm trying to control that I shouldn't be.
Yeah.
So it really keeps me humble, keeps me Kelly's going to smirk when I say that word. Keeps me humble, keeps me focused, keeps me mindful.
Yeah.
Can somebody be healed? I'm not going to say they can't. In my experience, I haven't seen it, and certainly I can't. So now I'm, and again, I'm not, you know, the substance use disorder is diagnosed based on behaviors. So if you stop those behaviors, do you still have the disorder?
Right.
I don't know.
That's a good point.
Maybe, maybe not.
Right.
But I know me, and I know how I'm wired, and I know that given the opportunity, I do things to excess.
Yeah.
So I know I will never be cured.
Yeah.
I get a daily reprieve based on my spiritual condition.
That's right. Yeah, that's a good, I like that, daily reprieve. Based on the maintenance of.
Exactly.
Our spiritual condition.
Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's what the disease gives to me, the opportunity to maintain my spiritual condition daily.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't without this, I promise you. I grew up in the church.
Yeah.
But God was like my suit I put on when I went to church. You know, I had a relationship with him while I was there, and as soon as I left, I took it off. And even in recovery, this drives me crazy, even in recovery, you'll hear your spiritual life, whatever you call it, is kind of siloed along with all these other things, equally with all these other things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how's your spiritual life? Oh, it's good. Okay. Okay, how's your financial life? Okay, it's good. It's okay. Okay, how's your relational life? Mm-hmm. And silo them all together, and I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. God's overarching
right. All
of this, you know? You know, we can't say, make God your number one priority, not your number four priority. You can't. God permeates priorities, you know?
Right. I love that. Yeah, that when someone's like, do you put God first? It's like, the second you're putting whatever that is, and you think you're calling it God, the second you can put it anywhere, it's no longer God.
Yeah.
Right? It's an idol or an object. It's no longer the thing that cannot be put anywhere. Like, we're put in it, in a sense, right? Like, yeah. But I think you get to that point, right? Like in your early recovery, I imagine your concept of that higher power, God, it's evolved over time, right?
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
I mistook religion for spirituality, in my early recovery.
Me too.
And thought, well, I need to go to church, thinking that was the only place I could commune with God. And I promise you, I commune with him a whole lot more. And I tell in AA meetings, you know, a bunch of fairly rough-looking no offense, tattooed up people sitting in a room together. And man, I have the most spiritual connection with those people.
Yeah.
You know, God's there and you can feel it.
Yeah. Yeah. Religion has, like, the etymology of the word religion is to bind together.
Hmm.
Or to rebind. And so religion has a good, in its best use and best practice, it does bind us together by a set of beliefs or a set of doctrines or a certain way of living or eating or rituals and things like that. And in its right place, religion is a beautiful thing to leverage us to a better society, to a better personal health and all those kind of things. But unfortunately, we kind of take religion and then we put it in the place of God, right? Because doctrines and ideas are so much more tangible than whatever makes atoms and, you know what I mean, electrons whirl around.
Oh.
Atoms. Sorry, I feel like I'm talking a lot, but you're firing me up, Bill. You're firing me up.
I love that. That's so true. And again, we love the church. We both go to church regularly and get a lot of what you're saying there. But the church can become your God. And I don't want to offend anybody, but a lot of these mega churches that have these pastors that are put on such a pedestal, a lot of times it's the worst been the pastor.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. The professional Christian.
Yeah, exactly.
Guy that gets paid to be. Yeah.
Yeah, I think my answer for that question is, can it be cured? The only, what I would call cure to addiction that I have experienced or witnessed is pain. But it's such a relative thing for people. And I think enough pain experienced and then respected and like care, like keeping that with you motivates people to do the maintenance.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. I think there has to be buy-in for people to embrace like a completely different lifestyle.
Yeah.
And that I wish I could like pinpoint that for each person. Like this is what you need to get to that buy-in stage, but it's so, you know, everyone's bottom is different and their motivations. Like maybe not everyone needs to crash a plane to get there. And then some people die before they ever get to that point, you know?
Yeah.
But I think the turning point for anybody in long-term recovery is at some point they experience enough pain where embracing a different lifestyle all of a sudden became easier than keeping on how they were.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. The very thing that we think is the enemy to us is actually it's the blessing, right? It's the gift that we're given. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of my worst days were actually my best days.
Yeah.
Because of what it brought about.
You won't see me at my worst. Wait till everything's going right. Terror. All right. Over the years, another question for the room, really. Over the years, sitting with men, what have you learned about human nature? How many you think have sat across from you?
I've never done the math.
Hundreds.
Hundreds. Sure. Definitely hundreds. For sure.
So you've seen people come in at various stages of life and pain, and you know. So I'm imagining over those years of sitting, 15 years of being in that role, what has come up to you that you say, "Oh, that's true about humans."
We all have those basic needs of love, acceptance, and worth. Every human being. I've never met some that said they didn't, and then it was obvious they did. That we're all so much more similarly wired than we like to admit, because of the world. Because we, and addiction is kind of that great equalizer. Doesn't matter socioeconomic background, race, color, religion makes no difference. Sex makes no difference. We all have those basic human needs, and you know the thing with addiction is we're kind of branded the stigma that goes along with that, and it's just not true. You know, there's good and evil in everybody.
Yeah.
You know, the whole dichotomy of man thing. There's good and bad in everybody. And the fact that we were addicted does not make us bad. You know, we did some bad things, of course. But we're not bad people.
Yeah. Do you think that's a hard one for people to get over?
Absolutely. Like
all the guilt and the shame and the self-hatred?
100%.
Yeah.
And that's the big thing. You take my medication away that was keeping me from feeling all that. So now what? You know, we're just kind of left dangling. That's why early recovery is so hard. So hard.
Yeah. Unless you get that pink cloud where you're like just happy to not, you know.
That wears off, or it did for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure, me too.
Yeah. I don't know if I even had a pink. I think maybe I did have a pink cloud. And then it wears off.
People were telling me that, like, my first time in treatment, because I was so happy to not be dope sick for the first time in years. Like, oh, yeah, you're just on this pink cloud. I'm like, what are you talking about, dude? I feel great.
It's kind of a horrible thing to say to someone. Like, finally feel good about life, and we're like, just wait.
Yeah.
It'll get worse.
It's going to suck again soon.
And then I hit, like, pause, you know, post-acute withdrawal syndrome, and it was like the whole world was caving in. Like,
yeah. Oh. You have all those clinical buzzwords. I'm impressed.
Well, I'd never heard about that until I was in it. And the therapist or whatever was like, oh, you're experiencing
diagnosed
pause.
You with it.
I'm like, no, I still got hands. Like, she's like, no, post-acute withdrawal. I was like, man, that would have been nice to know before today, because right now this is terrible and I want to get out of here.
Yeah. So sitting with men and over these years, you've learned that we all have that kind of as a human nature, this need for, and how do you think, what's the most healthy way to get those? Love, acceptance, safety, security.
Right. Well, to me at least, the source has to be from God, your higher power. It can't be from yourself. And to me, that's what I was trying to do was earn it or get it or manufacture it myself, trying to control myself and everybody around me. I was an air traffic controller for many years, so it's in the title, controller. I was a control freak.
While you were getting high?
Can I say that?
I don't know. I hope nobody has a flight coming up, and I hope you're not listening to this on a plane right now. I
haven't done it in many, many years. During the same time frame, absolutely, 100%. I'll tell you stories later, but yeah. For sure.
So you had this sense of that you could control things.
I tell people where to go, and they have to go there.
Yeah.
And then I come home and tell her where to go, and she won't do it. And it's short, you know, a short circuit. So to be told that I'm powerless and something's unmanageable, nah, not me. I control things for a living. That's what I do.
Right.
So trying to find my worth and my acceptance out of what I did. If I introduced myself to you, I'd say, "I'm Bill. I'm an air traffic controller." That was the first words. That was my primary identifier.
Yeah.
And that's where I got all my love, acceptance, and worth. So who am I when I don't do that anymore?
Yeah. You know? I always hate trying to give that answer. Like, what do you do? And if someone asks me that, I'm always like, oh, which one? What do I?
Yeah.
You know, what do I say?
How do you answer it?
I don't know. It depends. I don't know. I have a ton of answers.
What your is spirit, like I have spirit
a thousand,
led?
I have 1,000 lies for the question, how are you?
Yeah.
A thousand lies for the question, what is God? Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, I don't know. But I always like that was all that's like a big thing was like when, especially like when I was working for Steve and them, they would call me the IT guy. And I hated that. I hated that because I'm like, I'm a creative.
Yeah.
And you're pigeonholing me into this IT guy thing. You know, just because I'm the only white guy here doesn't mean I'm the IT guy. Shit. You know, like, come on, dude. Give me some credit here. Like, I'm a creative. And so that's always been a thing, like, you know. And then what I noticed, too, is, like, I'll put on these identities, right? Like, I'm ordained. And so there was a time when I really liked that reverend title, you know. And then I think, like, if I'm ever giving a talk or something, I usually start with, I think, the primary thing, which is I'm a dad and I'm a husband.
Yeah.
You know? Because I think as I've just continued to grow and live, that's the, like, primary role in my life, you know, in this natural world. It was Andy Stanley that said that, you know, it's the one thing that I can do, especially being a father, that I'm uniquely qualified for. Because even if I were to pass on and my wife was to remarry, they might call him dad, but that's not going to be that role as a father is the one thing that no one else on this planet can do for my children. And so that's kind of like the main thing. Like, you know, when I think about who am I, that's probably the first truest answer is that, right?
Andy Stanley, another quote I kind of live by. He said, the most important thing you do in life, the most important gift you give to the kingdom, may not be anything you do. It may be somebody you raise.
Mm-hmm.
Then he went on to say that might be raising your kids. That might be raising other men. That might be, you know, raising your employees, whatever. But that really stuck with me.
Yeah.
Finding your love and worth and acceptance from actually raising others up.
Yeah.
You know,
that's why we're here in this building.
Yeah.
You know, that's why we got this spot, you know.
You know what I heard Thursday that I absolutely loved? It's the guy who was talking about he's getting custody of his son for the first time in his life, and he's going to be a single dad, and he's freaking out a little bit. I mean, he trusts God, but he's still freaking out. And somebody told him, it's like, look, dude, all you got to do to be a good father is to first be a good son.
Mm.
And I think that's kind of the answer for all these problems that we have, you know?
Yeah, understanding that there's something above you that's guiding you and
fathering. I love that, dude. I reflected on that this morning in my quiet time.
Yeah. Where do you quiet time? On the toilet?
No. Front porch. No, I'm not like a first thing in the morning kind of guy, like in that regard.
I do my quiet time going 70 miles an hour down the 400 freeway.
Yeah. Front porch.
That's not quiet time.
Rocking chair.
That's driving, sir.
Coffee in hand.
On the porch, coffee in hand.
It's quiet.
Yeah.
Peaceful.
You're pretty consistent?
Super consistent. I'm really? More consistent with that than probably anything else.
Yeah. What about you, Bill? Are you consistent with a daily?
That's the one thing I'm very consistent with. I get up. I'm an old man. I get up at like 3:30 in the morning. So I'm at No Longer Bound at where I work by 4:30 a.m. So from 4:30 to 5 is my quiet time. And I'm the only one awake in that, I think, in probably that part of the state. So I'm I'm really quiet, really a good time to do it.
What is that quiet time? What's that consist of?
Usually reading my daily reading, a little Bible verse I have on my app on my phone. Mm-hmm. I also have a AA app that gives me a daily reading. I read that. And then a lot of times I prayed. And I realized that my prayers were more like a Santa Claus list usually than a communion with God. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times I just meditate. I just kind of get quiet, get still, and just kind of be there with Him.
Yeah.
And I give gratitude. I have to give gratitude.
Yeah. That was your, I asked Adam, what's Bill want to talk about?
Yeah.
And he goes, what was it? The power of gratitude?
Yeah.
And I sent him this emoji, with this slap face like this. Oh, my God.
Heard that so many times.
Right? Yeah, it's like whenever, like, the topic today is gratitude, and everyone in the meeting goes, oh, yeah. Gratitude.
I'm right there with them a lot of times.
Yeah.
But it has to be a decision I make. Sometimes, to be honest with you, I have to make myself do it because I'm not feeling terribly grateful sometimes.
Yeah.
But what's the remedy to that? Gratitude.
Yeah.
And really, what's the alternative? Because if I'm not grateful, I'm self-centered. I'm resentful.
Entitled.
I'm in comparison. So it's either that or that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll take the drudgery of gratitude. You know,
I like that, the drudgery of gratitude. Yeah, because I feel like it's like hard to manifest gratitude, like real sense of like, yeah, you know, I'm thankful and grateful for where I'm at.
I learned a trick on that.
Come on.
When you get a little older and you have grandchildren, because I start my gratitude with my grandchildren, and it's not hard to manifest that, being grateful for that.
Yeah.
And everything starts springing from that, you know.
That's adorable.
So pick out something that you just adore, something that is you're the most grateful for on the planet.
Start
your gratitude with that and see if that doesn't kickstart.
Oh, that's good.
Manifesting other.
That's
gratitude.
A great icebreaker.
Yeah.
Into the drudgery.
Into the drudgery. Here we go again. I'm grateful for socks and toilets and pants and electricity. Yeah. All right. Well, that covered that there. All right. So what can Jesus teach us about recovering from addiction and mental health issues?
Good Friday. Let me see. Well, I think first and foremost for me that I am worthy, that I have worth. You know, today's the day when He died on the cross, and He did that because of me.
Mm-hmm.
And I personalize it. He did it for everyone, but He did it for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'll read John 3:16 and plug my name, for God so loved Bill. He gave His only begotten Son, that if Bill believed in Him, I personalize it.
Yes.
Because it was personal.
So it gives you a sense of worth and value.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That thing that drugs and alcohol gave me. And when I look at being sober as long as I've been sober, how did you do it? You know, the old thing, how'd you do it one day at a time? One day at a time, with that realization every single day that I do have worth. That I do have value. Why? Because God says I do.
Yeah. Because you are, because you exist, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not because of what you do or...
It's not because of who I am or what I do or what I've done.
Yeah.
It's just because I am.
Yeah.
So you grew up in church, right? So
yes.
You had that belief, or maybe, I don't know, a concept of that.
I had that concept. I've heard that.
But like it shifts when, like, once you truly experience that, you know. At least that was true for me, because I grew up in church and God's good, He loves me, cool. Like, I still feel terrible. But what like shifted into, what transitioned you from this transfer of knowledge to like transformation?
Experience, life's experiences, needing desperately to feel that. In a point in my life where it was literally life or death.
Yeah.
And God came through. You know, it's all, you know, kumbaya, Jesus loves me, this I know. But until you actually need it and feel it, it's just up here. It's the connection of up here and down here.
Yeah.
It's knowing it and feeling it in my spirit versus just knowing it in my head.
Every day.
Yeah.
Because, like, that's how, like, my quiet time is reflecting on the previous day's devotional that I do with my fiance. I'll, like, reread the previous day because she's usually just getting up and we haven't done the day one, or, like, the day of one. And my prayers are always, like, just so thankful, you know, mm-hmm. that, like, God saw fit to love me in my mess and love me through it. And still, like, I just, that has not faded for me. The just overwhelming, like, joy of just feeling so loved by God.
Yeah.
It is hard to, like, it is hard to have a bad day when you're in that, you know?
And that goes back to that stigma thing we were talking about, because this, just the, well, in any mental condition, there's a stigma that goes along with it. I'm broken. Something's wrong with me. I'm flawed. Mm-hmm. I'm not worth as much as others, that whole comparison thing. So being reminded every day that, yeah, you are. You know, if it had only been you on this planet, Jesus still would have come and died.
I was thinking that, too, when you asked, like, you know, with substance abuse or mental health, like, how does Jesus inject into that? You know, in both of those schools or of people or both of those populations in treatment, I think, like, the main question asked is, like, all right, well, like, what's wrong with you? You know, tell me what's wrong. And, like, in my quiet time, God's telling me, like, what's right with me. And that's so, like, affirming and building and grounding and,
yeah,
I don't know. I think when that shift happened for me, like, everything changed from the inside.
You must have a magical porch or something, bro.
Maybe. It was the same at No Longer Bound.
The only time I get that is at the ocean.
Yeah.
When I'm standing at the ocean and the waves are, like, not panhandle ocean. Like, real ocean.
Real waves.
It's like real waves that can knock you down. That's when I get that sense of, like, oh, there it is. But it takes something like that to really enter into
something
it.
Awe-inspiring?
Yeah, otherwise.
Where you feel small?
Yeah, otherwise this thing is just clicking too much and I can't sort through who's the hell is talking. This is being honest, right? And usually what happens is I have to start taking action in the day. And then little synchronicities or things would go, and then I go, oh, there it is. Yep. Reminders, right, of kind of like who I am, right, or whose I am. Or and it takes, but sometimes the sitting doesn't always create that for me. I have to make some motion.
And to be fully transparent, I am super consistent in doing that, and sometimes that will last all day. Sometimes that will last 45 minutes, mm-hmm. and I'm right back in my flesh, and I'm right back doing the things that kind of got me there, you know?
Yeah.
I'm with you. Sometimes it feels good, and it's there, and I know it's real, but sometimes it takes some time during the day for it to come back up and go, oh, yeah, there it is.
Yeah. And I think that's the dance of it, right? Like, I think that's spiritual living. This idea that spiritual living is this rocket ship of, you know, tiptoeing through the tulips, that spirituality, but going back in and forth, you know, between struggle and acceptance and, oh yes, I am like this connected individual to I hate everyone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is pretty much my extreme.
Oh yeah.
You know, a lot of us are extremes. And I used to condemn myself for not being able to stay in this spiritual mindset. And I realized, well, the fact that I return, right, is what it makes it a spiritual mindset. And when we don't return, that's when the problems start, right, for too long. But it is like a dance to me. And sometimes you get out of rhythm.
My grandmother used to say, you can be so heavenly minded, you're no earthly good. So you get in that, stay in that spiritual realm all the time, and what good are you, you know?
You can be what? So heavenly minded?
So heavenly minded, you're no earthly good.
Oh, boy, that's good.
I don't know that that's possible either.
We should put that, like, on the wall.
Just like you were talking, I was picturing like wavelengths.
Yeah.
you know, like I'm super grounded in the morning on the rocking chair. Then I'm driving in Atlanta traffic and I'm cussing at somebody in front of me. Like, why are you driving on 15 under the speed? There's not one in front of you.
Yeah.
And it's like these intervals of like, I give something to God in the morning and take it right back.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, shoot, what am I doing with this? Here, take it again. And it's just that. And I think like the goal is to just shorten the intervals.
Yes.
You know, I think the more spiritually mature or spiritually grounded or connected we are, the shorter those intervals are. But I don't think they ever disappear because we're like, we're imperfect, we're fleshy by nature, I think, and it's just all about that constant and
if it,
being intentional.
If we didn't go back, we would be cured, right?
Right. We wouldn't need a savior.
Wouldn't need it.
Right. Yeah. Who wants to be cured from humanity? It's kind of dope. You know what I mean? It's kind of cool. Like, you know, being able to climb things and cut things down and, you know, like, it's pretty rad.
Thumbs and stuff.
Dude. Let's go. Like, being a human is, you know, pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not ready to, like, just be a spirit floating around, whatever happens there. You know what I mean? Playing a harp and singing all day. That doesn't sound fun. So I kind of like this human experience, right? Which is also, to me, what Jesus teaches us, right, is God and human, right? The joining of divinity and humanity together, that fully God and fully human. And Richard Rohr says that Jesus is the archetype for humanity. Apostle Paul also says that, the second Adam, right? He's the archetype. He's showing us how to live in union with God, the Creator, right? And, you know, we see him do some things that are wild, flipping tables and cursing trees. And, you know, he does some stuff that's kind of like, oh, why'd you do that, dude? And I think that's the thing that I take a lot is that concept of like Jesus as a friend, right? That someone who gets it, understands that I can. It's like, you know, I can take anything in that connection because I'm not going to some thing that can't see me in my filth, right? I'm connecting to this intercessor who can say, "Oh, I get it.
Totally relate. Yeah.
I know how that feels." Relatable. Yeah, and I know it sucks, and that's what I need. I need someone to say, I know it's hard, but you can do it. Without the I know it's hard, and someone just says, you can do it, it's like toxic positivity to me. But that's what I really get out of Jesus and the Jesus story. And the other thing is that there's a process, right? Because he was born and lived and did this whole traveling, gathered a bunch of criminals and thieves and tax collectors, everyone together, and did this whole thing to make this point, right? And to be born and to die, that there is a process to this stuff, and that just because it doesn't happen like that doesn't mean it's not God, right? Or if it comes in the form of another human, which is usually how God speaks to me, is in the form of another person. But I think Jesus has a lot to teach us about recovery. And, you know, unfortunately, it just gets kind of like shuffled into this religious thing. And we kind of lose the sauce with it, you know. And to me, there's no better example of what it's like to be human, right? And to truly love and be connected to other people. And I think Jesus teaches us that in a real way.
The ultimate 12 stepping, right?
Yeah.
I think in like religion, like growing up in religion, like Catholic, you're taught to perform to get in God's graces. You know, and I think in spirituality, like you recognize that you've already received that, and the response is to like want to honor that.
Change the way you move.
Right.
Yes.
To be obedient and honor these things you've been given that you can recognize, like, you don't deserve.
Yeah.
We don't deserve. But God gives them freely to us anyways.
Yeah.
And I think the response when that's truly received is to honor that.
Yeah.
To try to model or emulate how Jesus lived, how he treated other people.
You're responding to love, and that only it creates more love to come out, right? And so it's just, as opposed to, like, duty and, you know, discipline.
Obligation.
Yeah. All right. So when we close the show, which we're about to, we like to ask our guest is someone who's listening or watching, what would you tell that person, someone who's on this cusp of making that transition and living a new way? What would you say to that person?
I would say it's worth it. I would say it's not, you know, you said it's not tiptoeing through the tulips. You know, if you're looking to just be happy the rest of your life, good luck with that. But there is something available that I just say it's peace. There's a peace available. There's that, you know, the opposite of those, of not having that love, acceptance, worth, and security is anxiety, it's fear, it's depression, it's loneliness. You don't have to live like that. There's something more. There's something more. I tried the just staying sober route without any kind of life change. I'm not going to change anything else. I'm just not going to drink and use. And I was what I guess they call a dry drunk. And I'll be honest with you, if that's sobriety, I'm going to stay drunk.
Mm.
Seriously, because at least I got something. But there's more. There's so much more. The promises that they talk about in the rooms come true. So it's worth it. It's available. You know, have hope.
Amen. Thank you, brother.
Yeah, man.
Thank you for being here. Thank you, Adam, for being here. Thank you to our tiny in-studio audience for being here.
Round of applause for them.
This has been an episode of The Most High Show. Thank you to the donors and supporters who make this possible. And if you need help, don't hesitate to reach out. Peace.